Good evening. Welcome to the Spring 2015 Green Living Seminar Series at the Massachusetts College of Liberal Arts. Each spring semester, we invite a series of experts to campus to present on various aspects of sustainability. This semester, our series topic is issues in climate change. Over the course of the semester, we have invited experts to speak on various issues of climate change, including policy, energy, nature conservation, science, advocacy, and activism. Tonight's speaker is Dr. Jennifer Shirk, manager of the Citizen Science Program at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology. Dr. Shirk works to advance the field of public participation in scientific research through the Cornell Lab of Ornithology's Department of Program Development and Evaluation. Through citizenscience.org, she supports a community of practitioners who lead, manage, implement, and research citizen science projects. Specifically, she provides workshops, resources, and networking opportunities to facilitate effective citizen science project design, implementation, and sustainability. Much of this work has been through a partnership with the Association of Science and Technology and Technology Centers to implement a citizen science as a tool for investigating local indicators of climate change. Before her arrival at Cornell in 2001, Dr. Shirk worked in both scientific and educational capacities for the Smithsonian's Conservation Biology Institute, the USGS, and Shenandoah National Park, Catalina Island Marine Institute, and Penn State University. She serves on the Board of Trustees for Green Springs Natural Cemetery in upstate New York, where she is exploring the use of citizen science to monitor management impacts on grass and birds. Jennifer has a BA in Conservation Biology from Bard College and an MS and PhD in Natural Resources from Cornell University. Following Dr. Shirk's lecture, we will have the opportunity for questions and answers. Dr. Shirk's lecture tonight is entitled Citizen Science and Climate Change. Welcome, Dr. Shirk.
Thanks, Dan. And I'm glad to be here, actually. It's really nice to be back in this part of Massachusetts, right at the foot of Mount Greylock. I did a southbound AT through hike in 2004, and this was one of my favorite sections of the trail. So y'all are in a really lovely, lovely location. Just for the record, since I understand this is being recorded and potentially posted online, I'm not manager of the Citizen Science Program at the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and I won't get into the politics of the organization. I'm manager of one resource for citizen science, a website called citizenscience.org. And I work to support the larger field of citizen science beyond birds. Actually, I'm not a birder. I'm a herpetologist by training. But my research has moved into, and the area of expertise that I'll bring to this talk is neither about birds or climate change, but about citizen science and how citizen science can be applied to the study of birds and the study of climate change. And even the study of climate change education and learning about what's happening in this really sometimes controversial space. And I'm going to start this talk actually with a story. I'm a big fan of stories, and this is one that takes place here in Massachusetts in the southeastern part of the state, and it's a story of a woman named Kathleen Anderson. So south of Boston, in the 1970s, Kathleen Anderson was taking note of what was happening in her yard. She was a big fan of watching and recording the species around her. And on this particular night, not too far from this particular time of year, in 1970, on March 27th, Kathleen Anderson wrote down that she heard the first spring peeper of the year. So 22 years later, in 2002, on March 3rd, Mrs. Anderson wrote down that she heard the first spring peeper. Quite a different time of the month. Quite a bit earlier. Two data points. Do not a trend make. However, when looking at an entire set of Kathleen Anderson's journals, and I'm going to skip ahead a slide here just to show you the compiled information that she kept almost daily for decades. Two researchers at in Boston, several different universities, Richard Premack and Abe Miller Rushing, read through these journals with a fine-tooth comb and started to track those observations to show that over a span of 30 plus years, 22 different plants and animals had shown significant shifts in their trends of becoming active or blooming or fruiting earlier and earlier over that span of time. 22 different species. That looks more like a trend. And Mrs. Anderson isn't alone. Around the country, and in fact around the world, people in their backyards and their neighborhoods and their parks nearby have been observing and recording changes for arguably centuries. If you think back to records of cherry blossoms in Japan, date back to over 800 years. And recently, within the past 10 years, 15 years, scientists have started to recognize the importance of these observations and these records for helping us to make sense of change that has been happening around us. And in fact, careful observations that have been made by interested individuals really are helping to fill in details about how people and plants and animals are responding to a changing climate. And these observations are really starting to point to ways that species in some places are changing their habits as the climate changes. So as you all have been hearing, or many of you have been hearing throughout this series of lectures, we're really living in a time when, as a global society, we're forced to ask questions and address problems on an unprecedented scale. And we face large-scale challenges to human and environmental conditions that we've never really before had to try to understand. And if we think about trying to understand some of these questions, particularly related to plants and animals, we might have to look at impacts such as changes in the ranges of species, or changes in the phenology of plants or animals. And phenology refers to the timing of such things as migration or seasonal movements, changes in breeding timing, changes in when plants leaf out or flower or fruit. And we also want to be on the lookout for changes in climatic events, which we often think about in terms of manifesting as weather events. But when you look at them over a long period of time, they point to patterns related to climate. Just anecdotally, recently I heard somebody try to describe the difference between weather and climate as weather being one candy and climate being the entire box of chocolates. But really what we're talking about are changes that may be happening on such a large scale that any one individual, particularly any one individual scientist, really has a hard time trying to capture in data. We really need to answer global questions, data that cover wide geographic areas, and not just wide geographic areas, but cover them in quantity across those geographic areas, and cover them in quantity over those geographic areas for a large period of time. And then we don't want to know just about any one animal. We want to know about a diversity of taxa that might be affected by climate change, plants as well as animals. We want to know about how those changes might be happening differently in different habitats. We need to know what's happening on private land as well as on public land. And we need to know that all through a standardized, rigorous methodology. Again, scientists are really good at standardized, rigorous methodology, but they're not so good at being everywhere all at once. And this is where citizen science can really come into play. And these kinds of data are what citizen science can be uniquely positioned to provide in many different contexts. And in this particular talk, I'm going to be focusing on climate change and the impacts of climate change, particularly on plants and animals. But there's a whole world of citizen science out there that addresses everything from changes in phenology to changes in water quality, to looking at trends in public health and molecular biology, and just about every discipline of science. But to give us a quick snapshot of what I mean when I use the term citizen science, I'm going to offer you a definition, and a definition that actually comes out of a dictionary, not so much because I'm a fan of using dictionary definitions, but the fact that the term citizen science is in the Oxford Dictionary is fairly significant. This was just published last year as a formal definition in the OED. Scientific work that's undertaken by members of the general public often, and I note here, not always, but often, in collaboration with or under the direction of professional scientists and scientific institutions. There's a whole world of citizen science out there. And importantly, most of these projects, most citizen science projects, didn't really set out to look at climate change. Rather, most of them set out really to look at more topical data collection, potentially related to birds or related to plants or related to water quality. And yet they're a really powerful source of information about global change. Because through citizen science, people everywhere, anywhere, can use basic scientific protocols to report observations about natural events. And hundreds of thousands of participants all across the globe now are contributing millions of observations every year, allowing us to ask and to answer questions that we've never before been able to address. And the picture that I'm showing you here is an example of our eBird project from the Lab of Ornithology, and observations that come in through the Lab of Ornithology eBird program. And the first time I saw this map, I thought, well, there goes that rigorous scientific protocol out the window, because what are these data sets doing down here, right? Those data points, they can't be right. They're out in the middle of the ocean. Well, let me tell you, this is actually an old map, and if this were more current, there would be data points just about everywhere on the globe, because it's now a global program, and not only are data coming in from every continent, data come in from such things as pelagic birding tours, where people pay to go on guided tours out into the middle of the ocean to look for really incredible species that you'll only see if you get out into the deep southern Pacific, such as albatross. So just to give you an example of the power of these data through eBird as just one example of citizen science, I'm going to let this animation play through for just a moment. So unlike the previous map, these aren't data points. These are models of data points. This is what can be done through data that come in by the hundreds of thousands of observations on an annual basis that can be aggregated into a data set that lets us look at the probability that any one bird species is going to be in any one space at any given time. This would not be possible without hundreds of thousands of observers all across, in this case, I'll go back, the U.S., who can help us see when birds are most likely to show up where. In the case here of just a single species, the indigo bunting, as it migrates up across the Gulf of Mexico into North America and then back south again at the end of the year. So eBird, just over, and this starts in 2003, I recognize that's really hard to see there, and goes forward just 10 years. And you can see the growth of input into the eBird data set of not just individual observations, on an annual basis, but also checklists which comprise multiple observations over a period of time. And this may give the impression that eBird only has data that we can make sense of dating back until 2003. And as some people in this room can tell you, that's not the case. In fact, although eBird started in about 2003, it accepts data even from old checklists. And in fact, was started based on the fact that there were amateur expert birders out there recording observations and then stashing their observations in shoeboxes and putting them in their closet, never to be seen or heard from again. eBird allows those individual observers to share those data for these kinds of scientific investigations, and also for those observers to have a digital record that they can make sense of themselves to look back at when they're most likely to see what kinds of species in their local habitat. So eBird is one really powerful program that allows us to try to apprehend global change and global impact on bird species. But I'm going to give you a few other examples. Another one from the Lab of Ornithology is our Nest Record Card program that dates back to the 1940s. And these are cards from, I think that if I'm, I can't read the date now, but I think 1973 it says on there. So we have decades and decades worth of these Nest Record cards. And as we start to work through them, scientists are showing that species such as the tree swallows are nesting as much as 9 days earlier. And these are old data. These are over a decade old. Current research is showing even more significant trends. From another project with an even longer history, the Christmas Bird Count, which was started by Audubon in the early 1900s, is really showing us that many species of birds are expanding their range northward. So they're making changes in where they're showing up on their ranges. And these are just, again, a few examples, but if we start to look larger scale, climate change research on birds, understanding the impact of climate change on birds across multiple species, has heavily relied on citizen science. I was involved in a research project that looked at a synthesis study published by Knudsen and colleagues in 2011 that made 10 claims about how climate change was impacting bird species, everything from range shifts to nesting dates to a few other parameters. That paper itself didn't reference citizen science. But when we dug into all of those 10 claims and all of the papers that they referred to make those claims, up to 74% of the research heavily depended on the Christmas bird count, the breeding bird survey, the Nest Record Card program, eBird, projects around the world that relied on amateur experts making contributions to scientific studies. So citizen science is really a vastly underappreciated source of data for what we know about citizen science, at least related to birds. But it's not just birds. A subject close to my heart, amphibian biology. The New York State Amphibian and Reptile Atlas is showing us that frogs are calling as much as half a month earlier. There are phenology networks across Europe that are drawing on centuries of data from amateur observers that are showing us that many, many species are changing their phenology. And one project on monarchs is using data on both monarchs and the plants, the milkweed, that they need to breed to start to look into the future about how climate change will impact this species and predicting that in the future the ideal conditions for the milkweed to grow are going to be far further north then the monarchs themselves are likely to be at that time of year, pointing to potential disconnects between really necessary environmental relationships that these monarchs will depend upon moving forward. So each story on its own that we hear about monarchs, about frogs, about birds, is important. And together they're really pointing to large-scale changes that are taking place and the large-scale impact that climate change is having on many, many species. But that's just one side of the climate change story through a citizen science lens. Because citizen science can impact not only the science, but also potentially the way that that science can make a difference in the world. Because the volunteers and the participants and the observers in these projects are a critical part of the equation, not just from what they can contribute to scientific understanding, but what they can learn through the process of being involved. And the way that I first got connected to citizen science and climate change was through an initiative called Communicating Climate Change, or I'll call it C3 for short, was the name we used for the project, which began to really try to put citizen science in service of making a difference in the way the public understands the impacts of climate change in their own backyard. This was an NSF-funded project that worked with 12 science centers around the country to each work with, or in some cases, design a citizen science project that really looked at a local potential indicator of the way climate change was being experienced in that particular part of the world. And the goal was to both engage people in the process of science as well as to engage people in the process of understanding the meaning of that science that they were contributing to through these citizen science projects. To really help people and increase opportunities for people to engage with and interpret data and increase their capacity to communicate about these data and the science to make evidence-based decisions about climate change. And at that time, this was the landscape that we were working in, the human landscape that we were working in related to climate change. This is research by Tony Leiserwitz and colleagues at Yale in his work to try to understand across the American public how people related to the concept of what they were referring to at the time as global warming. And through a number of surveys, they really pointed to different ways that people related to that concept. Everything from being really alarmed by or concerned about this idea of climate change to being doubtful or even dismissive that climate change was something that was not just of concern, but even happening. So when we started the C3 project, we were well aware that there was a wide spectrum of beliefs and understandings about this concept of, again, this research refers to it as global warming, but something that we call climate change. Because the way that people at that time, again, and this is going back more than 5 years, there was this perception that global warming really had to do with melting ice. You know, so something that was happening far, far away that wasn't really close to home or relevant to, you know, my experiences or my backyard, that wasn't going to affect me, and probably something that was going to happen down the road, something that was a future concern that wasn't really relevant to things we needed to worry about right now. those were the perceptions of the American public at the time of these studies. And so it wasn't really something that people were talking about as anything that had to do with local ecosystems. It was really ranked low by people in these surveys among choices of different pressing environmental problems. And respondents to these surveys really had limited concern that global warming would harm their families or their communities or anything that they really were invested in. People in these surveys notably did indicate more concern about potential harm to plants and animal species, but that was hard to tease apart in some ways from the image, the greatest image that people had in their head about climate change. If I had to ask you what animal people probably associated with climate change, what would it be?
Polar bears.
Polar bears, yeah, absolutely. So what does that mean to me in my backyard and here? That was what we really set out to try to address through this C3 project. And so again, we were working with 12 science centers trying to identify for each location an indicator that they could monitor with members of the public in their community that was locally meaningful and scientifically relevant. And helping people who were involved in these projects try to situate local observations in a larger context of both time and space. In other words, trying to make sense of what I see now in relationship to the larger climate change picture. I'll give you just two examples of ways that that this shaped up in two different science centers that we worked with. One was our local science center in Ithaca, New York. Every science center was also paired with a scientific institution as a partner. They happened to partner with us, the Lab of Ornithology, and adopted the use of our NestWatch project. NestWatch had decades and decades worth of data, again, from this Nest Record Card program. So there was a historic data set. The youth who were involved in monitoring nest boxes that they set up around the science center, around their schoolyards, were able to contribute their data to this larger pool of data that we had from dating back to the 1940s. The idea being that they could start to look at how their data made sense in relationship to data going back decades and really start to explore change over time. Another example, a little bit of a different kind of project that happened at the Museum of Discovery and Science in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. They struggled a little bit with their local science partner, couldn't really find an indicator with an existing citizen science project, and ended up designing their own. One of the dangers of doing that was that they wouldn't have a historic data set to look back at to see whether climate change was influencing patterns or trends over time. What they did have was a particular parameter that you could make sense of right away. And that was related to a locally meaningful indicator related to climate change, sea turtles that came up and nested on the beaches right near the science center that they were already monitoring. And they added a component to monitor the nest temperature. So the temperature of the sand at nest depth. Does anyone here know anything about how sea turtles respond to the temperature of the nest? I think somebody was in the class earlier. Do you want to share what it is that happens when sea turtles are nesting if the temperature changes?
Well, they produce more males, a higher percentage of males, actually over a certain temperature. I think in some cases it was up to 100% a male population or embryos.
Yeah, there's a fun phrase, hot chicks and cool dudes, that fits for sea turtles. If the temperature rises above a certain point, it will be all hot chicks, all female nestlings, hatchlings will emerge from the nest. Below a certain point, it will be all male hatchlings emerging from the nest. And so there's a sweet spot of producing a mixed ratio of male and female hatchlings from the nest that's really necessary for the survival of the population. And so although there wasn't a historic data set that this project could contribute to or look at to reference whether they were seeing change, they had a target temperature that they knew if they rose too far above or potentially dropped too far below was going to indicate that there was a potential problem related to at least changing temperature, which could be related to changing climate over time. And they actually had great success with this project. They were courted by Disney to take it up. It was adopted by a bunch of regional hotels. So visitors who came to the museum or even came to any of the regional hotels could check out a kit, go do a little bit of geocaching. Do folks know geocaching? To use GPS parameters to find not the nests, because the nests themselves are federally protected, but a station where there was a temperature, a thermometer at nest depth. They could drop the thermometer down through a PVC tube to nest depth, take the reading, reel it back up, and submit their data instantly to the museum's data set and see where their data point fit within the larger trend of monitoring over that that period of months. So folks got involved in these projects. Again, there were 12 of them. They were monitoring everything from moisture in the redwoods and related to sword ferns. They were looking at butterflies in some cases in South Carolina, a whole suite of projects that were taking place. And they had a really great success in engaging people in collecting the data. But the big question that we had going into this project was whether the experience of collecting those data made sense to people in the larger term of climate change. And that turned out to continue to be a real challenge for the C3 project, because interpreting data and making sense of data can mean one thing to scientists and mean something completely different to an individual who's just had a meaningful experience, potentially on the beach looking for sea turtles. So we really struggled with how to help people understand trends and relate their experiences to trends over time. And this challenge transcends not just this particular project, but it really speaks to a larger issue related to climate change and the political climate around climate change and how people really deal with data when we're faced with decisions about risk. One example of risk being the risk of climate change. And this is research, again, from Tony Leiserwitz, but also from a whole body of literature related to the way people make decisions, which really notes that there's this assumption that we are rational beings, right? That we will make evidence-based decisions, particularly when we're thinking about something that's really serious. It's assumed that we're rational. It's assumed that we're analytical. It's assumed that we're cognitively engaged in a problem. But particularly in relationship to climate change, there's a lot of research that's shown that people, as much as, if not more than, base their decisions about affective aspects of a problem. How they think about a problem emotionally, how their values sit in relationship to a problem or a situation of risk. And so elements of emotion and of values and of trust are just as much at play when it comes to making decisions in the face of data that may be perceived as not having anything to do with where we are. And so just to look at this in a conceptual way, and relate this to climate change, to citizen science, and thinking about how we were rolling out this Communicating Climate Change project, or C3 project, we were really trying to figure out how we could integrate this experience of recording data and dealing with information to the experience that people were having when they went out to make those recordings. Because, again, the literature around decision-making and risk really is showing us that both of those things are necessary. In many cases, this outweighs that. So there was an opportunity here for citizen science to play a role in integrating something that looked like this, discrete data points, with experiences that may look more like that. And it's still an open question as to whether we can do that. It wasn't a question that we were able to answer by the end of the C3 project, but we did learn quite a lot from some surveys that we conducted throughout the duration. Particularly, learned a lot about the way that the Science Center audience responded to the opportunity to become engaged in these citizen science projects. And this is research that was done by our evaluators at David Heil and Associates. And we really could see that Science Center members in general were more concerned than non-members about climate change, but not that much different from the national percentage. So non-members are maybe more on par with the general public. So we weren't necessarily preaching to the choir with the folks that we were reaching out to, although we were more inclined to get to folks who were a little bit more thinking that climate change was something that was happening. But we looked at this in the context of that research from Tony Weiserwitz, and the way that people might be convinced to change their thinking about global warming. And again, this is going back to those different categories that were pointed out, but looking at how likely they were to change their mind in relationship to the audiences that we were reaching at science centers, it was these groups, those who were potentially concerned or maybe cautious about climate change, that are falling into this range of maybe being willing to change their mind. So we have an opportunity here to speak to a group of people who really are potentially, we might be able to move the needle a little bit. And we use these categories to listen to some of the things that they were saying we might be able to move the needle on. Now, I will point out that more recent research has shown that things that don't move the needle include giving people more information. And if we think about communication about climate change as providing people with more facts about climate change, that really doesn't work. And in fact, if we look at these two sides of the spectrum, this more recent research shows that more information will further polarize each side. People who are convinced already about climate change will become more convinced. People who are convinced that climate change is not happening become more polarized and convinced when given scientific information that scientific information is to be dismissed or to be thought about incredibly skeptically. So just providing people with data doesn't work. So how do we potentially reach these groups? Some of the things that we were learning was that these groups were really looking for evidence that was relevant to them locally and information about how science happens. Both things that we have the opportunity to do through citizen science. So really looking to help people understand by doing science, not by telling them about science, but by doing science, what's going on and how we know. Because we're really living at a time when the role of evidence in this conversation is contested. And again, these are slightly old data, but I showed a graph earlier that indicated that back in 2003, the strongest image that people had when they thought about climate change was melting ice. More recently, in 2010, the strongest image that people had when they thought about climate change was naysayers, was the doubters, was the skeptics. And so how do we start to have a conversation about not just what we're seeing, but the role of data and the role of science in helping us to understand how science can contribute to that conversation? And how can we think about something that we might call a trust capital, knowing that people who come to science centers in particular are inclined to trust the science centers as brokers of information and trust their neighbors, they told us. They were inclined to trust data that their neighbors collect in contributing to citizen science projects. How do we foster that trust capital in having a conversation about climate change and the science of climate change? And one thing that we really learned, potentially, was that there are other interests that people have besides just plants and animals. And one that really rose to the top was this idea that we should be thinking about how climate change impacts people as well as plants and animals. And that's an area of growth for citizen science and one that I'm excited to see expand, because there's an area of citizen science that I haven't talked about so much in terms of the way people can become involved in projects. I've talked about large-scale projects like eBird that look to amateur experts and ask them to contribute their data to a large-scale project. I haven't so much talked about the potential for citizen science to really also listen to communities and where they're seeing evidence of impacts in their own communities, where their concerns lie, what they're worried about, where their questions are coming up. And in fact, some recent research in communications related to climate change are really showing us that some of the biggest action on climate change, the biggest changes, the biggest legislations that are being made related to climate change impacts, addressing climate change impacts, are happening in Florida. Florida is a huge state of skeptics. Why is change like that happening in Florida? It's because the conversation has happened around the impacts, not the cause. The conversation has happened around the problems. What are the problems that people are seeing? And if we could start to capitalize on that as a place to start the conversation, we may have an opportunity to make a better connection between communities, data, and what we start to understand as the impacts of climate change through science. And this is a conversation that's happening at the national level. And I was involved, just in closing, I want to share that there's a project called the National Global Change Research Program, which is a federal initiative to put together reports on the impacts of climate change, which this year has held a symposium to understand how citizen science can become a big part of what they're doing. And part of the conversation included not just looking at citizen science as a way to collect data, but as a way to connect around data and to look at indicators not just related to plants and animals, but to look at indicators such as related to livelihoods, to economics, to public health, and ways that climate change is impacting things that people on the ground are really dealing with on a very immediate and day-to-day basis. And I'll just leave us with a couple of questions about how we might think about citizen science as an opportunity to, moving forward, reach an audience with really diverse attitudes and understandings about climate change, and think about citizen science and its potential to build trust around science and scientific research that engages both emotions and values as well as data and information. So lots of questions and lots of potential moving forward, and I look forward to discussion around some of these ideas. So thank you. A couple of questions. I don't know if Dan's hand was up first, but you'd like to start here?
You're citizen scientists. Yes. Is there some kind of experience level, expertise level required so you're assured that your data is good?
This is the biggest question that comes up related to citizen science, and arguably it's the most important question that always comes up in relationship to citizen science. But arguably it's the most important question that comes up with any scientific research project. How do you know your data are good? Scientists are always tasked with the challenge of collecting and analyzing data in a rigorous way. To do that with volunteers requires a different set of considerations, but it's still the biggest thing that needs to be addressed, is making sure that the data are collected in a way that can be used. Every project is different. So our eBird project, for example, has a whole suite of technical and human parameters that go into carefully vetting every data point that comes in. It also is benefited by the fact that a huge mass of data allows us to make conclusions, to draw conclusions that wash out potential outliers that can't be done if you're dealing with a much smaller data set. Then again, eBird works at a global level and doesn't train the volunteers. There's no training that goes into an eBird volunteer or contributor from the eBird project itself. Local projects on the ground, very small-scale projects, have the opportunity to do very rigorous and hands-on training and testing and vetting with their volunteers. In fact, I've talked to a researcher at the Golden Gate Observatory in California, Alan Fish, who works with volunteers who go through hours and hours and hours worth of training. And he's very selective about who he involves and who stays involved in his observation program. And so that's just two ends of the spectrum on ways projects might deal with this issue of data quality. It's something that every project has to deal with, and it has to be dealt with specific to the question at hand. Not every data set has to get you the most perfect data. You have to get data that are relevant to the question that you're asking and trying to answer. And so I was telling the class earlier when we were talking, our NEST record card program, although it's more robust than this, at its heart is really, how many eggs are there? That's a fairly simple question that just about anybody can answer, and it's an easy one to engage youth in, for example. What's today's date? How many eggs are here today? How many eggs were here yesterday? What's changed?
I wanted to ask about the kind of person that engages in citizen science, and in particular along the lines of this increasing trend in our society for people to sort of stay inside.
Yeah, going back about 5 years, we actually started a project to try and do exactly the first part of your question, to try and get people off the couch and outside, and it was related to observing nests. It was looking at pictures from Nestbox cameras, getting people who were on their computers interested in doing this kind of online work I referenced a project earlier to the class that there are citizen science projects that engage millions of volunteers in looking at and classifying images online. We tried to take a project like that with images of nests and nesting behavior and use it to inspire people to get outdoors. Didn't work. For a variety of reasons that I could talk about if we want to follow this thread of conversation. It had to do with who was inclined to be involved in what kinds of projects. And I think what you're hitting on at the end of your comment there is really more at the heart of where the conversation is now. How do we bring these two things together? How do we bring the online outdoors? And how do we enable people who may be outdoors casually to connect more with the tools that they have on hand that they're inclined to use? There's a huge project that started up called iNaturalist that's all based not just on the idea of classifying photos, but on taking photos and contributing. People can set up a personal profile and then take images on their smartphones, upload them, and ask people, what did I see? What is this thing? And then around that, people have started to build up all kinds of different projects. What's being seen in this park? Or what's being seen over a period of time in a particular species? And so it's using smartphones and screens as a tool to facilitate deeper engagement. Different ways that will work well, different ways that we're still learning how to make those connections.
How did you advertise for those 12 programs that you spoke about?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because another question that often comes up related to citizen science is, how do you get people involved? So we worked with 12 science centers who all sort of competed to be partners in this project. And we strongly advised each of those science centers to adopt an existing project that would already have infrastructure in place, not just for dealing with the data, but also for recruiting participants, for getting people involved. Now, many of those projects were happening at a large scale, like our Nest Watch project from the Lab of Ornithology is national, actually continental, I think goes into Canada for sure. But we had, you know, recruitment materials, we had a website, we had places where we could point people. But one of the values that we really saw of partnering with a science center from our side was that the science center could maybe reach out to new audiences and connect with people in new ways that we as a national continental organization couldn't do. We can't connect on the ground with everybody in every place. And so in that particular case, the Science Center was working with after-school programs, and they were looking for something to do with that audience that really brought a science activity to a group of students. And so they weren't specifically recruiting for anyone, but they were using the opportunity to reach a new audience. The other example that I gave, they recruited in a completely different way, the Sea Turtle Project, and found this really exciting opportunity to work with hotels as a tool for getting people who were visiting the area to do something science-y. It's really cool to do something related to sea turtles, right? But every project is different. People are looking at all kinds of creative ways to recruit participants as relevant to their project. Not every project, like the one at the Golden Gate Raptor Observatory, always recruits new volunteers. In fact, Alan has told me he intentionally does not recruit new volunteers. He wants people to come to him when they are ready to commit. He wants to vet the volunteers who come. But then others are looking for anybody to engage. There's a whole suite of projects that happen online on a platform called the Zooniverse. This is the sorting and classifying images projects. From images from the Hubble telescope, images from the Serengeti and wildlife, and they recruit in all kinds of ways. In fact, there's a whole website that has sprung up specifically to recruit people, not to a particular project, but just to the idea of getting involved in citizen science. It's called SciStarter, and they really work to promote citizen science and citizen science opportunities for anybody who's interested.
Yeah. What do you do about sensitive data and locations of rare species that might be subject to poaching effect? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, again, every project is different, and it's a huge concern. I'll add another parameter to that. What do you do with data that point to people, right? Like to personal privacy? For the eBird project, I'll answer this sensitive species one, we can cloud out what's shown or the resolution at which information is shown publicly related to species of concern. And that's one way that a number of different projects have dealt with it. I've talked a lot with one citizen science leader, Nolan Duskin, who runs a project called COCO-ROS. That stands for Community Collaborative Rain, Hail, and Snow Network. COCO-ROS. And it's a national precipitation monitoring project where people often monitor their backyards every day. So what do you do when your data are publicly available and somebody could look and see, oh, so-and-so hasn't been monitoring this week. They must be out of town, right? So there's personally relevant information that can be revealed through these projects, and projects are grappling particularly with that second question all the time, and Nolan's come up with some creative ways to deal with the importance of having geolocated data, but the ways that he can make that a protected set of information for the people who are contributing it, to not reveal too much that's that people want to hold private. That's a big concern also, and this is not related specifically to climate change, but in new citizen science projects that are springing up around health, public health, genetics. Privacy is a big concern, and one that the field is rapidly grappling with. I'm not sure if I mentioned at the outset that right now I'm involved in an initiative to build out citizen science as a larger field of practice, and helping a new association called the Citizen Science Association, and this is, as a new field, something that the association is doing, is trying to advance a conversation around issues of concern and best practices along the lines of privacy, along the lines of engaging volunteers, along the lines of dealing with this important concern of making sure data are rigorous so that we can say citizen science is something that has value. So that's an actively growing field and, as always, actively growing conversation.
Great. Thank you for coming tonight, Dr.
Thanks for having me.